You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
During the next hour or so, we will be discussing the fourth season of a strange cultural artifact originating from a small isolated planet called Earth, lost on the other side of the galaxy. Farscape was screened many cycles ago for the enjoyment of the human race, distant relatives to the Freling Sebastians, many of whom make up the Peacekeepers. Farscape follows the adventures of a group of renegades led by the infamous human John Crichton, Erin, Dargo, Zan, Rigel, and Chiana aboard a sentient ship known as Moya, fleeing from the wrath of Krace and Scorpius, both obsessed with the wormhole technology that only John Crichton possesses. Designed in Australia by the Jim Henson Studio, merging early CGI and puppetry, the space opera brings us to the uncharted territories, creating a visually baroque depiction of the universe light years away from shows like Star Trek or Star Wars. Slightly forgotten, Farscape deserves a few microns of your time.
Arkady Martin is the author of the Texicalan series, a multitude of short stories, and various other works of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. She is also Dr. Anna Linden Weller, who is a Byzantinist, a climate and energy policy analyst, and a city planner. She is not bored, but she is often tired.
Arkady Martin, welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you here today to discuss the television series Farscape.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
It's such a pleasure. And as you may know, we like to open the podcast by asking our guests, why did you choose this series and what does it mean to you personally?
That's a great place to start because Farscape is probably my favorite episodic television show, certainly in the science fiction genre. And I've had productive arguments with lots of people about who like other ones better. But for me, this very peculiar Australian, deeply committed to the bit show from the late 90s and early aughts, it's kind of where I saw and hoped at the time. I was pretty young when I watched it the first time, like in my teens, when it was on television. I just loved how it was simultaneously utterly gonzo, like absurd in its degree of being willing to go there, and deeply emotional, incredibly challenging, ultimately hopeful-ish, but in a way that was not easy. It's the kind of story that really resonated with me and still does. I go back to it every couple of years. I used to have a sequence of how to introduce my friends to Farscape to get them into it enough that they watch seasons 2 through the end straight with me.
And were you already watching a lot of sci-fi shows at the time, or was this really something that started your love for the genre?
No, I was watching other things. So my father was a big science fiction fan, though mostly books, not TV. Like, we weren't Trekkies or Star Wars people, but I had watched Trek and I had watched Star Wars. And I had also really enjoyed Babylon 5, which was on a little bit earlier. And I was watching that again in my early teens. It was on in the afternoons after I got home from middle school and high school. And I had watched a lot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer also, which was very popular at the time. And definitely, in some ways, I could consider it a contrast to how something like Farscape felt, something that was much more oriented towards a speculative fiction version of real, quote unquote, or everyday life versus something that used speculative fiction to talk about the world in a way.
There's so much to dive into with Farscape, but I'm just thinking back to this time when you were watching it as it aired and thinking about the way that the series evolved with what was happening during the time, and in particular, the reference to 9/11, which comes a bit later in the series when John's father directly references the fact that we live in a different world now. 9/11
Yes.
has happened, and John hasn't had that experience of the transition because he's been off world since that happened. And I'm just wondering how that affected you as well, and how you feel about the relationship to current events in the United States, for example, because it is an Australian show, but also with so many
It's an
direct.
American show with, well, it's a show in some ways that's about America and the world, in a very indirect way. Like there's nothing except for those episodes that you're talking about, and they're really central to the show. They are some of my favorites, and also I think some of the hardest to watch, for me personally, mostly because that's when you can't really place any distance between yourself and the science fiction anymore. When it comes back close, and you have to think, oh, what would I do? Do I agree? Do I think about this the same way? And I'm glad the show did that, actually, because I think that the arc of John Crichton, the protagonist, is he begins desperate to get back to his original state, to get back home. And that drives him through the majority of the show, even as he is radically transformed by trauma, by love, by madness, by injury, all sorts of really awful and occasionally really great things happen to him. And he is not at all the same person by the time he gets a chance, maybe, to go back home. And one of the things I found most powerful watching that part of Farscape is that a character who has spent the entire arc of what we have seen from him in this story, wanting one thing, deciding that he probably shouldn't have that thing, that he shouldn't go home, that he should go back to the rest of the universe because the world is not necessarily ready for the kinds of bad choices and hard choices that he has had to make. And I find that incredibly merciful. Of Crichton, and also very sad, but it's one of the points that I actually find hopeful in the show, because someone who has been hurt and changed and understands things in a much more complicated way than he did at the beginning of the show, makes a choice to protect other people and to let them have their own experience of making those choices and not make them for them. And I really like that.
It's true that underneath the playfulness that you find in a lot of the episodes, which can be light and funny, there is an anguish that is located in relationship with the earth, with that origin point, and about the possibility of bringing danger back with him to this origin point. In a sense, it reminds me a lot about the Odyssey, about the impossibility of returning because you're not the same anymore, and the people you've left are different too, and you're bringing back your baggage with you, and that's really problematic, possibly.
And they have new baggage with them too. Like, it's not just the traveler who it is changed, it's those who stay. I have always, my entire creative life, been interested in exile and what happens to people at the edges of things. I think Farscape is actually probably one of the reasons I'm that interested. I mean, you don't necessarily know something is formative when you're watching it, but when I think now about some of the ways that I, as a writer myself, am willing to let my characters and the stories I write not come back to where they started. That sometimes the process of being in the world and having the plot happen to you means that you cannot go home. And that might be really sad, but it's also okay. Both can be true. One of the things that I admire about Farscape is its willingness, despite its both silliness and like silliness that converge into horror, which is one of the things I adore about it, is that it's also very willing to allow people to be human, or that's the wrong way to say it, to allow people to be people, because some of the people who are people are not human at all. But to give them, the ones who stay, the ones who are drawn along, sometimes the incidental characters who we only see for one episode, the kind of depth of feeling that real people have of complicated and not singular motivations.
Yes. Of making mistakes and learning from their
Yes.
mistakes.
And sometimes not learning and
Yes.
making things worse.
Yes, yeah. And going in a cycle of mistakes.
And what do you think about this contrast between the fact that, on one hand, it's a co-production between multiple countries. It has these very strong links with Australia, where the series was based. And at the same time, there are constant cultural references that are very specifically American. John Crichton is sort of the apple pie boy in the beginning, whose consciousness expands to the point that for me, it was such a turnoff in the beginning. I think Crichton's sort of humor and some of his Americanisms, and then you come to the point where you realize that he's quite lovable. And but anyway, that's another aspect of his character development. But just in terms of the contrast between having a co-production and this kind of specificity that we find with his humor, with constant pop cultural references to everything from politics to the Wizard of Oz, which is such an important reference in the show. I'm wondering what you think about that. And I'm also trying to imagine how this was for international audiences, because I didn't watch it at the time when it came out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an American, so it's some of the international is hard for me to imagine how it would be coming to it fresh. I think that especially pop culture is hegemonically American in the world right now, and was even more so in the late 90s and the early aughts, especially in the world of relatively high budget television. That in many ways, an Australian production that wanted to have any sort of audience outside of Australia probably was going to have their best bet at making an American story. I also know that many of the writers were American, which changes things, even though most of the actors are Australian. And I also think that there are aspects of this story that would be difficult to tell from a non-hegemonic perspective. Crichton needs to be confident in his own cultural supremacy at the beginning of the show, so he can be less confident in it as he goes along and eventually be willing to give it up.
I was just thinking that's if I can say so, that's a very Martinian theme, isn't it? Idea of a clash of empires and a cultural supremacy being imposed on other people, isn't it?
It is certainly what I think about a lot of the time. And it shows up in most of what I write, even the things that are not overtly about empire. I think cultural production is incredibly powerful and is both a creator of and a weapon of state and political formations. I'm a historian, I can't not think those things. But I also think that, like anything that is powerful, it is a tool for a lot of people to pick up. And I actually, it's one of the things I love about Farscape, is that it does not reify the story of American centrality. In fact, it goes out of its way to undo it over and over again.
I'm a huge fan of your writing, and right or wrong, I couldn't help but, as we were finishing the series, I was also reading A Desolation Called Peace. And so I couldn't help but make certain links, right or wrong, especially thinking about language and the way that language infiltrates consciousness or how we are enhanced. And I was thinking a lot about For instance, the fact that characters on Farscape, have this ability to understand one another, that translation automatic because they've been injected with this ability to do so. And of course, I was thinking about neuro enhancements, but also the idea of really how we structure language and how we come to grasp the structure of other languages and what facilitates that. So I'm wondering, to what extent do you think Farscape influenced your thinking about language and communication?
Oh, that's so interesting because Farscape is all over, especially Desolation. Desolation's a very Farscape book, including the name of the primary battleship, which is named after a Farscape episode, sort of, kind of. But the language angle is fascinating because most of my thinking about the uses of language in science fiction come from C.J. Cherry, not from Farscape. That's where I have spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, so what kinds of linguistic problems does foreignness create in the science fictional world? I mean, I have other training in that as a historian and now doing policy work, that the way you talk about things kind of circumscribes your ability to imagine understanding other people. But thinking about language and Farscape, there's a kind of Doylist and Watsonian, if you know those terms, Doylist being like after Sherlock Holmes, Doylist being the authorial idea of why something happens, and Watsonian being like the in-universe idea of why something happens. So the Doylist solution to, oh, they're aliens, no one can understand each other, is obviously, oh, let's just give them all translation microbes. It'll be fine. Now we can actually have a show where people talk. And that it creates a constraint. Like, as a person who puts stories together in any medium, you have certain constraints that you need to work in that allow the story you want to tell to be accessible to an audience of any kind. And these constraints differ by medium. But one of the ones about language, which is very important, I think, for nearly all writers who have characters who do not come from exactly the same place, is how to portray and convey differences in linguistic ability, comprehension, just perception. It's emphasized more in science fiction because you have aliens. And the constraints are, how can I get my audience to come with me? In television, you probably need most of your characters, unless you're willing to work with subtitles the whole time. And there are shows that do that. I'm thinking of the work that the Game of Thrones team did on Dothraki and had a pretty developed, constructed language for that they then used consistently in the show. That is a choice. Farscape did not make that choice. Farscape made a choice that I think was probably originally a Doylest choice, like, let's just not have to deal with this particular problem, but becomes it all choices have Watsonian consequences. And in Farscape, the transparency of language allows the characters to believe they understand each other when they do not. When they do not really know each other, when they are in fact very different and have differing motivations. The show is quite interested in this, actually. It wants to explore surface motivation and the disguises people wear in public and internal motivation, true identity and secrecy. And we have multiple episodes of people donning not just disguises, which is quite normal for nearly any sort of sci-fi story, but identity disguises, which, and this show takes them seriously. Like, what does it do to to a person to pretend to be a different kind of person for a long time in public, high stakes? And it's the question of being a spy. What does being a spy do to somebody? Even if no one in Farscape spends real time like undercover, but there are several instances where, especially Crichton, but eventually quite a few other people, take on roles and names and attitudes which are not innately theirs. And that they usually as a method of getting out of some sort of terrible situation. But doing so has consequences, and it's one of the things I love about Farscape. But it's not just that. There is an entire really fantastically well done body swap episode where the actors get a chance to play other characters, which is wonderful. I love that episode.
Yeah,
and it's one funny. Of those that is on the surface just screamingly funny most of the time, but it's also quite important to a lot of the emotional arc of the characters at that point in the story. And what the show is doing is playing with the levels of communication. Yes, we can all talk to each other, but do you know what it's like to be somebody else? Can you? And then in the third season, they really get nasty with it and give us two versions of the same person. We have Crichton number one and clone Crichton number two, and they are both, for the instant of their creation, exactly the same. And they quickly diverge. And the question of, can even two people who are both of the same species, the same background, the same memory, the same experiences, are they the same person? Can you know somebody else at all? I was really interested in that.
I would even argue that the show asks questions about the possibility of knowing oneself.
Yes.
That you find as a recurring theme when it comes to Crichton and all the sequences that take place inside his own head with Harvey playing the role of a sparring partner somehow in his own psyche. But what you just said concerning difference and the difficulty to find the right connection with people made me think of Jean Baudrillard, who talked about this issue and who somehow had a problem with difference and alterity, that you cannot reduce somehow alterity by erasing the differences between people. And I think this is pretty much what you were saying about the show, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I like that as a reading, that erasing difference does not erase like separation. And like it's into like the questions of what is an individual, what sort of consciousness is an individual possessed of, and how does that relate to any other individual, and questions of experiencing and perception, which I am very interested in, as is probably very obvious from how I write books. I think also Farscape is, and I want to go back to what you were talking about Harvey and the inside of John's head. So Harvey is both an enemy and an ally for John in a way, and it's kind of a classic Jungian shadow self. But also in, you can understand Harvey as being a visible aspect of John's trauma. You can also understand Harvey as being a possessing spirit. And both are true at once, because even if we go with, okay, so there's a version of this other person, Scorpius, John's at the time greatest enemy, who has been inserted into John's head to screw him up. For that purpose, that is the purpose of this happening, to screw him up and to steal the secret knowledge that he has. And yet the entity that is Harvey, which is separate from its origin point, there is still a Scorpius out there in the world doing all sorts of things unrelated to Harvey and without continuity with Harvey. Harvey is changed by experiencing the inside of Crichton's head. Even in his incredibly initial appearances, like in season two in Crackers Don't Matter, which is another one of those screamingly funny, really awful episodes where you're laughing your head off and you really wonder why you are, because actually this is not nice or good, but it is funny. This is one of the first places we see Harvey as a interactive character. And he is already dressed in a Hawaiian shirt, screaming about drinking margarita shooters. He is not cohesive as his original self, if we can talk about a self. He is already interpolated with John. And what that suggests to me is that John is in some ways already interpolated with Harvey, and there is really no breakage that can happen. And I think the show is actually in some ways willing to go there in later seasons to talk about how having this kind of mind meld doesn't ever really go away.
But you were talking about psychoanalysis. I think it's also very much about the integration of the repressed takes place that is supposed to take place through the psychoanalysis process, isn't it?
Not that I think any therapist would really want much to do with any of the crew of Moya. That sounds dreadful. But yeah, if you, I think there's a, you could do a like a solid Jungian reading of Farscape as a whole if you wanted to. It's certainly not the only thing you can do with it. Nor do I particularly think that's what the original writers were doing. I just find it productive and interesting that you can think about the uncharted territories and especially the relationship between John and Harvey as being the process of integrating a shadow self into a whole person. On the other hand, the whole person you get at the end is kind of screwed up. So it doesn't quite land in that, like, what is psychoanalysis supposed to do for you? Make you not neurotic? No, the whole person at the end is quite neurotic, thank you.
I have a tendency to bring everything back to Twin Peaks, and I don't know if you like Twin Peaks, but
I do, yes.
to me, this is very much what happens to Cooper as well in season three with Bob and exploration of the various parts of his personality as Dougie Co Cooper, as Richard, and the way he ends up in part 18 is very similar to this complex, not totally likable character, but perhaps slightly more balanced in a way.
I can definitely see that parallel. I've never thought about it before, but I like it.
I'm wondering if we might talk a little bit about the aesthetics of the show, because so many of these themes are also anchored in the way they're represented in the show. And I think one of the most immediately striking aspects of the series are the use of the Henson Creature Workshop puppets that we see, and also a very theatrical use of makeup that really doesn't shy away from doing something a little different for the time. It was interesting to read that in the media, you could see that for a lot of publications that were not terribly favorable about the show, I think for them it was a bit of a throwback to perhaps aesthetic of puppetry that we associate with the 1980s. I'm thinking about The Dark Crystal, for instance, but it's one of my favorite aspects of the series. I think it's so special. And I think we wouldn't have this questioning of speciesism and integration if it weren't for the representation of these wonderful creatures that we have and the use of theatrical makeup art. So I'm just curious to know how you feel about that.
I love the aesthetic of Farscape. And I love it as someone who is really frustrated with CGI and generated science fiction worlds in current cinema. I think that when we left doing practical effects for the majority of making other worlds, we lost something really important. I love that a good 90% of Farscape is all practical effects. It is makeup, it's puppets, it's sets. There's some post-production stuff, like there's a very obvious bit in season one where they've just decided, the planet of the blue trees, and just put a filter over the trees. But one of the magic things about not using a ton of CGI is that this is a show from a quarter century ago, and it does not look like it. It really does not age the way early CGI does. And quite honestly, that early CGI, it looks old. It looks like I can tell when this was made. That's really, as CGI gets more complex, has expanded. There's stuff that I can tell, oh, that was made in 08 around there. It's not ever going to change because technology gets more complicated. But things that are physical look like they're physical. They have shadows, they have light, they have weight. Actors react differently to them. And this is one of the reasons that, from a practical level, I really love the puppetry on Farscape, is that these characters who are radically non-human in their physical form become something that takes up space and weight in the world that the actors really feel like they're there. And I mean, there are brilliant actors working today who, when I am immersed in a film or a TV that is mostly done with CGI, I think, oh, this is fine. Like they're really good actors. But there is a difference between someone who can touch something and lean on it and react to physical space instead of imagine reacting to physical space. That I think creates a sense of intimacy in the show that reflects the attention it pays to the personhood of non-human creatures. That I'm not sure that would happen without that kind of physicality being present.
And it's interesting because this personhood of the creatures, based on this hybrid nature, this mix of puppetry and CGI, is strongly felt, I think, with Moya, who is a fantastic idea to have this ship that is both metal and flesh at the same time, and who really becomes a central character in the show. I was wondering what you thought about Moya and
I love Moya. Moya is a person, a very different kind of person than most of the people on the show, but absolutely a person with volition and experience and desires and that can experience pain, and communicate the ways that there's a kind of symbiosis that is explicit in the show, which is that the humanoid characters live inside Moya, and Moya takes care of them and moves them around, but also has her own desires and wishes and sometimes does things that her symbiotes, I can think of the crew as being symbiotic with her because they take care of her too. But things that they don't want, would they have wanted her to go get pregnant and have a baby? No, not really. That would be extremely inconvenient. But people want what they want, even if they're giant spaceships. I also like the idea that the place in which you live is so explicitly alive. And there's a sharp contrast drawn between ships like Moya in Farscape and some of the ships that the dominant fascist culture, the peacekeepers, use, which are not alive. They are sort of your standard spaceships. And the way that the show's aesthetic capitalizes on that is to make their angles incredibly harsh, to use much more metal, to use a cooler color palette. One of the things I do love about Farscape in general is that nothing looks like the inside of an Apple store. I never have to look at like bland white iPods forever. Lots of different features, all of them very, very not very, very sticky. That's an odd word to use, but I do mean it. The choice of building environments that the show makes allows the characters to get stuck in the environment, to have to interact with it, to not have that sort of frictionless technology experience where you just point at something and it happens. And it, I think, both elevates the possible safety of a ship like Moya and the possible danger of other places where there are you will get stuck there. You will get entrapped in iconography, in harshness, in the kind being in the kind of place where it's probably a good idea to put on a really stylish uniform and have a very big gun.
Yeah, so it's not just neutral, it's not just a background. It is something with which you interact, isn't it?
Yes. And the show is really deliberate about that, even in throwaway episodes.
And there's something that really, really struck me about what I would consider almost a signature-like structure of a large number of episodes, and that is immediately being thrown into a situation without a lot of exposition. You're suddenly in the middle of it, and there's almost a kinesthetic transmission happening because it's very full of movement and sometimes tension. There are high stakes, and you're not quite sure as a viewer what's going on yet. Progressively, it's revealed how we got to the present situation. This strikes me as something incredibly unique with this series. Is it just me, or is this something that for you is also a signature of Farscape?
I think it's relatively unique. There are other shows that do it, but to be quite honest, a lot of prestige science fiction fantasy television does not trust or like its audience very much currently, and is not willing to challenge them in really any way. One of the things that I enjoy about Farscape is that it is uncompromising in its, you're just going to have to go with it. And it's not unkind. Like, as you were saying, it much of what is going on gets explained. But you have to make the leap. You have to be willing to go with the show and trust that you're going to land somewhere that is comprehensible. It's a style of writing that I wish we saw more of in television right now. There's very little willingness to allow for ambiguity or surprise. Everything has to be spelled out. Everything has to have like 18 layers of world-building backstory before anything can happen. I have given a couple of lectures at various locations about world building because people seem to like the kind I do. And everyone see comes in waiting for some sort of secret of how you build a complicated world. And the first thing I end up telling people is, well, I just pick shit I like and put it together. And then I figure out what assumptions would have to be true to make the thing I like the thing. Stop planning everything. And quite honestly, readers are not all of them, but a lot of readers and a lot of watchers are willing to do more work than you think.
And in your own process, excuse
Go
me,
ahead.
I read an interview with you in Clark's World where you noted the fact that for the most part, or at least at the time that the interview took place, you weren't a timeline builder, that you progressed incrementally. Is that correct?
It is correct. I don't really outline very much. I sometimes use it as a tool for pacing. Like, I've thought that, well, here's a list of things I know that are going to happen in this book in the next, I don't know, 10,000 words. In what order should I put them? I'll sit down, I'll write them out and be like, will it read better this way or read better some other way? But I am a very linear writer who writes very non-linear plots, and that's because I work heavily off of tone and theme. I find it quite difficult to write out of order because I don't know what linguistically will have happened in the previous scenes to make what I am writing have the emotional tenor that I want it to have until I get there. It also makes editing absolute torture because you have to like pull apart this very tightly knit fabric and find places to put things in. As I also chronically underwrite, probably by a good fifth of to a fourth of a book is just not there in the first draft. Or I think it's there, but no readers can see it yet because it's too dense and elusive. So then I have to go back and like try to give more space and more on-ramps for people. I do want, I again, I like challenging my audience, but I also want that challenge to be rewarding.
Yes. But it's so interesting to hear about your process, because I think that the more that we dive into alternative approaches to structuring the writing, the more we give way to possibilities like those that we see in Farscape, which are surprising compared to certain other formulaic ways of developing imagery.
I have lately tried to even more sort of disambiguate my process. Like I sometimes use things like ritual objects, like Brian Eno's the card set. God, why have I forgotten the name of it? I use them all the time. Sorry. Or even just a tarot deck to be like, okay, what if I did this, what would I, if I pulled this theme, like I've drawn the card and it's, I don't know, the star, what would that do to the scene I was thinking about? If I made that more prominent, does that help me? And I don't have to use it. Sometimes I just like, well, that's bullshit. But I like a certain amount of trying to not get caught up in being precious about my own structural process. It is a long process of learning to trust the fact that eventually it will come together.
But that's almost a Cagean sort of chance that you're throwing into the process. That's so interesting.
Well, I like that too because, well, first of all, I don't have to do it. And second of all, like any ritual process, any sort of divinatory tool is really about the interpretation between the individual and the symbol. And sometimes that's useful. Like, okay, I see this and I'm thinking this symbol and I'm thinking about my story. What do I want then to, does that have a resonance? Have I thought about that kind of symbology in the context of my story? Is what I come up with useful? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's, I'm trying lately at least to be more expansive in allowing my own knowledge to inform my subconscious processes. Eventually, this all gets to sound very mystical and strange. Honestly, most of it is just like, oh God, I'm stuck. What if?
this process, I was thinking, isn't that very much what John Crichton is doing with Harvey?
In some ways, yeah. There's a similarity there. Like, I hope that my subconscious is less predatory. Well, one can always hope for that. But yeah, the idea of being willing to ask the darker and nastier parts of yourself what you've missed is a very John and Harvey thing.
Since we are talking about your writing process, can you let our listeners know about your current projects or upcoming projects?
Yeah. So I have a novella called Rose House, which came out from a small press last year and is being wide released by Tor in the US and in sort of World English and Tor UK in the UK market in March of 2025, March 11th. Yes, it's also been translated into French really like gorgeously. So if you happen to be Francophone, you can read it right now in hard copy. Everyone else who wants hard copy has to wait till March. But it is out again in ebook now. And that is really a kind of experimental novella about art and architecture and alienness in a much more near future setting. It's kind of my ode to desert horror. I love deserts. I live in one right now, and they are a site rich with the possibility of horror. Actually, Farscape does that too. Farscape has a bunch of desert horror in it. Some of the absolute most terrifying episodes happen in wide open spaces or on planets that are desert planets.
Or space itself.
Yeah. Space is a sort of desert. Mostly people think about it as an ocean, but oceans and deserts are inverses anyway, so it's funny. Most your listeners are going to think that I am extremely spiritual, which I really am not. I'm just having that kind of day today, I guess. I like symbolism. We'll go with that. I find it very useful. And so Rose House is out in wide release next year. And I'm really happy about that because the original run was so limited and so few people actually got to read it. And I was lucky that some of the people who did read it liked it enough to nominate it for a Hugo, which I happily lost to Ursula Vernon, who's like the best person to lose to because her work is brilliant. But I really am like super excited about having that be in just a bookstore that people can walk into and get. And my current project that I'm working on, which I'm hoping will be like a 2026 book, is actually a sort of spy novel, which working title, guys, my publisher has not signed off, is called The Trace, and is a little bit about extractive industries and a little bit about city magic and a little bit about loyalty. And I read a whole bunch of Le Carré. I love Le Carré. I love the kind of claustrophobic internality of spy novels. And I've done aspects of spy novels in Tixcalan, but I wanted to do a real one. So that's what I'm working on.
Fantastic. We are really looking forward to that. And especially with your interest in empires and different cultures, I can just imagine comparing that to Le Carré, thinking about what that might look like, signed Arcadie Martin. That would be.
I am hoping it will be in some way worthy of the comparison because Carré is just dang.
We usually like to close the podcast by asking our guests if there's a question that perhaps we should have asked but haven't asked.
Or that you wished we had asked.
Yeah.
Oh, we haven't talked about Aaron's son even a bit. And we should.
Okay.
Because the show does not work without her.
Yes.
Farscape has a protagonist named John Crichton, but probably the most important character in Farscape, in my opinion, is Aaron's son. And she has what looks to be an obvious emotional arc of, I am closed off, trapped by my heritage sort of person who has no access to my emotions. And that is, and she learns to feel, and it feels, when I say this, it sounds really corny. It's actually not in the story at all. But that is the surface level of her development as a character. And what I love about Aaronson is her ability that she discovers to be a wider kind of self that she is. Crichton goes deeper, Aaron goes wider. Aaron, who has thought of herself as a very narrow sort of person who is a soldier and a good one, and that's about it. Because she becomes aware that she could be a scientist, that she could be a lover, that she could be a friend, that she could be the sort of person who takes stupid risks for other people. That she could be a mother, which is a relationship that she did not have any experience of in her own life. And the expansiveness that this show allows its female protagonist to not confine her to the, we started with sort of a very masculine, quote unquote, female protagonist who then becomes more feminine. That's really not her arc at all. She is a very feminine woman from the beginning who figures out that she has room to be a person in the world. Even as her world gets materially less nice over time, she goes from a position of high safety to one of extreme danger, and she never gets to leave that pretty much. And yet she spends the entire arc of the show figuring out that there is more space inside being Aaronson than she thought there was, and she can occupy that space. And I kind of love that. I find it very inspiring, actually, that that a person can get more themselves even as their world gets harder.
And relying on the trust that they build within the Scooby gang on Moya.
Yes, like relying on other people, being willing to. That is, and yes, it does circumscribe some choices, relying on other people does, but it also opens up new ones.
And do you feel like that sits within a certain theme that we notice at the time, or a certain motif that we notice at the time, with kind of the emergence of stronger writing for female characters that are more fully formed than we'd previously seen? A bit writing perhaps on the initiative set in Buffy, for example.
I think that that's absolutely true. There's room for Aronson in the world of prestige science fiction television shows because of the work that emerged from shows like Buffy, and a general sense that a female character can have a complicated internal life, and that can be as compelling as any other character's internal life. Complicated is the thing I'd stick to. And I also think that Erin is more well-written than a lot of female characters that came later than her. That one of the magic things about Farscape is that it took risks that pretty much no one else did at the time, and some that have not been repeated often.
And I could be wrong, but do you have the feeling, as I do, that Farscape is a little bit forgotten today? I mean, if I think about concomitant shows like Battlestar Galactica that overlapped with Farscape, I think there are still quite a few fans and viewers that come to Battlestar Galactica. Firefly has its own following. But what do you think about Farscape, and have you engaged with the fandom of Farscape?
Yeah, it is more forgotten than it should be. And part of that has to do with the ability to get it on streaming, which has been extremely intermittent. I will cling to my DVDs with commentary until they literally are unplayable. If you can get your hands on the old commentary DVDs, they are worth it. Just listening to the, it's really good commentary. Like, it's one of those things where, like, if you liked this podcast where we talked about Jung, you should go listen to the director commentaries, because they're interested in their own work in a way that I adore. I love people who want to think about how they made something. But Farscape's like the thing that everyone mentioned second. You ask someone what their favorite sci-fi show is, and they say Battlestar Galactica, or like Babylon 5, or often various versions of Star Trek. And then you say, well, what else do you like? And they say Farscape. I also think that the fandom got kind of kicked in the head by the way that the story ended. Because I was in the fandom a little bit right at the, like, season 3, season 4. I was about 17 years old at the time. Reading fan fiction and, like, hanging out on message boards, that kind of thing. And the indifference of the major channels to the fandom. And this is, again, we're talking like 03 here. There's not nearly as much recognition like there is now of fandom being a cultural force. In fact, it really wasn't as much of a cultural force at the time. And just the sense that, oh no, the sci-fi channel does not care even a little bit. They would like to do more Stargate SG-1, which is not a bad show. It's just a completely different kind of thing. So I think the fandom very much splintered after attempting to get the show revived and getting a miniseries out of it, which is better than nothing. But I don't see that kind of long-term community around Farscape that I did, or I do see among Firefly fans or other fans. It's just never developed that way. In some ways, that's nice. It means that people can come to the show without the weight of having a lot of people who know a lot about it telling them what they should like. They only get one, like, deeply annoying evangelist, me, who's like, no, you're going to watch all of my favorite show, all of it. We're friends now, right? We have to watch this thing. But it's also a little sad. I wish more people knew about it. It's more of a cult classic than something with an active fandom.
Do you think that perhaps the hybrid nature of the show, the mixing of CGI and live puppetry, might be part of the answer, while people maybe not take it as seriously as some other shows?
There's definitely an aspect of that. I think that was very true in the popular press at the time and the way it was reviewed. The people who I've watched it with and people who've come to it later almost don't notice the puppetry most of the time, which is interesting. Like, I think it's because they're so used to CGI.
Yeah.
So they are used to the impossible being just there.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite different now than it was when the show was first on the air. Mm. I also think that the show just basically got screwed over by the networks. It was hard to find it. Like, I want to watch the next episode of Farscape. I don't know when it's on. And this is before streaming, so it's not like I could go back and watch it later. So it didn't have the most support in the universe. And yeah, its reviews focused very hard on the weirdness of the show as opposed to the actual content of the show. And I mean, I think that probably drew in a couple of people who would otherwise have been uninterested, but it also pushed away a lot of people who would be interested. Because when people think, oh, Henson puppets, they think Muppets. And Muppets are quite different. Muppets are great, but they are not Farscape puppets. And the tonality of Muppets is not Farscape tonality.
But talking about the puppets, we haven't discussed the central character of the show for me, who is Rigel.
Right, I love Rigel. I mean, as much as one can. Rigel is, I always forget that Rigel is not like played by a very small person, which is the magic of puppetry. And Rigel has this really remarkable arc that repeats several times in variations of he's not a good person. He will never be a good person. But eventually he sort of becomes a person who does good things, which is different. And this show has so much room for moral ambiguity that most shows just do not allow. There's no redemption arc for Rigel. He doesn't need one. He doesn't want one. There's the resolution of trauma. There's the possibility of friendship, which is new for him, I think. Or new in the way that he acquires friends. There's a great deal of repeated betrayal where his innate personality, which is quite selfish, comes into deep conflict with some of the other characters who are making choices that put them in danger. And his sense of self-preservation is much stronger than most of them. Which I find interesting thinking about, because he comes from, in some ways, the most privileged of anyone on the show, even though he begins the show as an escaped political prisoner. He was, before he was a political prisoner, an emperor. And I think in a certain way, he does not actually expect the universe to screw with him permanently. And he's willing to make the universe the sort of universe that won't.
In a way, he's beyond good and evil. I mean, he's this sort of character, only driven by his hunger.
Yes, he is a creature made of his relationship to appetite of various kinds. But one of those appetites is for life, which I think probably is why I still really like him.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I imagine that you have at least several favorite episodes. Could you name one of them for us and let us know?
Oh, okay. See, I anticipated that you do this, and then I pulled up the list of episodes because I always forget their names. But I adore the sequence at the end of season one into the beginning of season two. It starts with Well, either starts with episode 18 of season one or episode 19. 18 is a little better. You can actually start the whole show at 18 if you want to instruct your friend a little bit on who all these people are. And 18 is called A Bug's Life and 19 is called Nerve. And these are the episodes where we leave the first structure of Farscape, which can be sort of Monster of the Week or Planet of the Week, and join up with the first major emotional and political arc of the show, which is about the Peacekeepers and Scorpius and John Crichton. And it's, if you start with A Bug's Life, you get to, for the first time, really understand some stuff about the Peacekeepers and their culture and what that culture means in a situation of extremity, and that there are both good and bad people inside that culture, like there are in every other culture. We've already met one who, Galena, who is a tech officer, but she is in isolation, at least up until this point of the show. So she's sort of an individual who, not a group or a representative of her society. And in these two episodes and the ones that follow after, right up until the end of season one, every little bit of common culture and common trust that Crichton has built with Moya and with the crew of Moya and with Aaron gets tested to destruction. And some things snap and some things hold and some things get remade during this process. It also introduces Scorpius, who is probably one of my favorite villains that has ever been on TV. I would also, I mean, for people who are squeamish, these are not good episodes to watch. Honestly, for people who are squeamish, Farscape may not be the show for you. It is very willing to do some body horror stuff that is extreme. There are some moments with eyes that I would like to forget. But it's also willing to make really horrible things like torture not pretty. No one suffers pretty in Farscape. When bad things happen, they are unpleasant. And this sequence also has like these incredibly like powerful, uplifting moments. There's the bit where Aaron rescues Crichton, and the dialogue is so good. Behold, the radiant Aaron sun. I just love that bit. And I love the moral test of what are people willing to do to each other when they have been hurt, which is kind of the question at the end of season one. Do two and do four. Like, what are people going to do to other people who have hurt them? Or what are they going to do for other people who have been hurt? And nearly everyone in the cast gets a choice about that. And they all make a choice. And some of those choices look good in the moment and end up being very bad ones. And some of them look bad in the moment and end up being at least ethically salvific eventually. It's also a really gorgeous bit of continuous storytelling that basically sets up the entire rest of the show. You can think that the structure of seasons 2, 3, 4 and the miniseries is set in motion in those two episodes.
That's a great pitch for the show. So if our listeners haven't watched yet, we hope that you'll dive in.
Well, I think we are reaching the end of this episode with Arkady Martin. Thank you very much for the time you've given for this episode. We really appreciate that. And we both actually absolutely love your work. So thank you again.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media. After Images.